At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university, online. That's a degree better. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills. Accelerate your team's impact and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more. My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Today on The Grave Talks, Ghostly Tales of the Berkshires, a conversation with author Robert Oakes. The Berkshires may be known for its beauty and culture, but beneath the rolling hills and grand mansions lies a haunted past. Today, Robert Oakes guides us through the eerie locales featured in his book, Ghostly Tales of the Berkshires. From Edith Wharton's haunted estate, The Mount, to the lingering spirits of Ventfort Hall and the dark mysteries of the Hoosick Tunnel, the region's ghost stories span centuries of tragedy, history, and the unexplained. Whether it's shadowed figures in gilded halls or spectral trains on long-forgotten tracks, the Berkshires offers a chilling glimpse into the paranormal. Today on The Grave Talks, Ghostly Tales of the Berkshires, with author Robert Oakes. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining me for an episode of The Grave Talks today. And I've decided you and I could talk for probably a couple hours, but I'm not going to put you through that. But you are an author, a teacher, a storyteller, and a performing songwriter. So you wear a lot of hats.
I do.
What I found really interesting right off the bat when we connected through Zoom was you said that you teach at a boarding school, and that's also where you live. And I didn't realize people still, you know, people sent their kids to boarding schools. And I'm like, what kind of sheltered life am I living out here in Kansas?
Yeah. Because we still don't, very much happens.
I don't think we have them out here at all, which is so interesting. How long have you done that?
Well, in this particular place, it's been about 2 years now, but I've been teaching for a while. I taught in the Berkshires too before then, and but yeah, it's been a good couple of years living here on dorm.
And what do you teach?
So I teach writing at this school. I also do communications for the school, so it's not strictly a teaching job, but I do continue to teach and work with kids. I've taught English and writing.
Now, you're also interested in the paranormal. You've written some books. You wrote Ghosts of the Berkshires, Ghosts of Northwestern New Jersey. And then you have one that's Ghostly Tales of the Berkshires. Is that more of a children's book?
It is, yeah. After I did the Ghosts of the Berkshires, the publisher contacted me about doing a children's book version of Ghosts of the Berkshires. And initially, actually, they were just asking me if I would allow them to do, you know, to bring in a children's writer to do a children's version. And I said, well, you know, I think I'd like to take a shot at that, actually. I would really enjoy the opportunity to write for children. And so I did. As it turns out, I had just been approached by a student here at the school who was in third grade, who I got this email out of the blue that this student was interested in ghosts and would I come to their classroom and tell them about, you know, the ghosts that I that I work with in the Berkshires. And so what I did was I had taken one of the Berkshire stories and I rewrote it for children and brought it to the class to read it to them. And I had just done that when the publisher contacted me about doing a children's book version of the Berkshire book. And I said, well, you know, I've kind of already started it. Let me take a shot at it. And so I proceeded to write the book. And what was really cool was as I was working on the book, I would bring the stories to these third grade students and share, you know, little bits of it with them to get their feedback. So they kind of became part of the process of writing the book. And when it was published, I gave them all a copy and they were super excited. There's like a little mention of them at the beginning of the book. So that was a really cool moment.
Oh, I love that so much.
Yeah.
Now, how did you, let me start that whole question over. Did you grow up in that area of the country or kind of moved to that area?
Well, I did grow up in the Northeast, but I'm from, well, sort of the North. I guess I grew up in New Jersey. So I'm not from Connecticut or this, you know, I'm not from New England originally, but I did move into this area about 20 years ago. I moved to the Berkshires from New Jersey.
Now, the Berkshires, that's Western Massachusetts, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much as far west in Massachusetts as you can get.
It looks absolutely beautiful.
It is.
Which is probably why you ended up there.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. At the time, I had just been on a trip to Ireland, and I was so inspired by Ireland. And I came back thinking, I got to get to Ireland. I got to move to Ireland somehow. I didn't know how I was going to manage that, but the opportunity came along to move to the Berkshires. And I thought, well, this is pretty close, actually, without having to leave the country. So I landed there instead.
How did you get interested in the paranormal?
You know, I often say to people like that, I feel like the ghosts found me because I didn't think that I was looking for this. I mean, I have had interest more generally in, you know, mystery, in spiritual kinds of things. But I wasn't specifically on the lookout for ghosts. And it was because of, you know, once I started working at the Mount, actually the home of Edith Wharton in Lenox, Mass, that's really what got me started specifically on this whole journey having to do with ghosts. I took the job there. It was, you know, I had sort of answered an ad. They were looking for a tour guide. It's a historic house museum. And they were looking for people to help out giving tours on the history of the house and on the work of Edith Wharton, who lived there, the author who lived there. And I had heard some things about the Mount being haunted, but I wasn't specifically interested in that. But it was that year I started at the Mount that they started their ghost tours, because there had long been this, you know, these stories that people would tell about the Mount. It had this sort of long lived reputation of being a haunted house. And it was just before then that the Ghost Hunters came to do an episode there for the first time. And so there seemed to be a lot of renewed interest now in the Mount's ghosts. So the Mount thought it would be a good idea to start up a ghost tour. And so it was the season that I started there that they began this ghost tour. And I went on one of these ghost tours and I was completely blown away by the experience and really kind of like knocked off my feet. In fact, I remember at the end of the tour, kind of sitting on the floor, I was a little bit like overwhelmed by the experience. It gets into some pretty dark stuff having to do with the fights between Edith Wharton and her husband, Teddy, his mental illness, and then, of course, all of the stories and all of the experiences. And it really did kind of knock me out. And I became really like curious about it a little bit. I don't know. I guess in some ways I was sort of wondering about like, what could this be? Like, is this real? You know, is this really a real phenomenon? Are these stories? Is this just something that, you know, once somebody starts telling a story, someone else starts telling a story and the whole thing just grows and grows? Or are people really having these experiences? And And I just became fascinated with it and got hooked. And so I started giving the ghost tours not long after that. I started leading them. And then after a while, it became kind of the main thing that I did at the Mount, was to lead these ghost tours.
Since we're on the Mount talking about it, I think it's real interesting. I think it was in your book or website, I came upon it, but it was talking about Edith Wharton as a child and how she was very, I don't know if she had a ghost experience or she was just very terrified of them and having an experience with one that she didn't want even a book in her house that had a ghost story in it.
Yeah, the story is that Edith Wharton became very sick with typhoid when she was 9 years old, and she was almost recovered from it. She took her a long time to get better, but she was almost recovered. And then she was given this book of short stories that included a ghost story. And she read this ghost story. I think she had never read one before. And it affected her pretty intensely. She said that, like, when she reflected on her experience in her autobiography, she talked about, or in one of the writings that she did about this, she talked about how reading this story, what her words were, plunged her into a world haunted by formless horrors. She felt that something what she called a dark and indefinable menace was following her after she read this story. She became sick again with the typhoid, and it just had this huge impact on her physically, mentally, where she became very nervous, anxious, and afraid. She blamed the ghost story. She felt that the story did this to her, that it, something about the story, the power that it has, the power that it had to affect her very sensitive imagination, put her through this experience, and she really became kind of terrified. She said that she, if there was a book of ghost stories in her house, that she had to burn the book because she was too afraid to have it like in the house with her. So yeah, it had this huge impact on her.
But didn't she go on to actually write some ghost stories?
She did. And that's something that so really impresses me about Edith Wharton, is that here's this thing that terrifies her.
Mm-hmm.
And she decides, yeah, I'm just going to go all in on this, right?
Like, yeah, she did.
I'm going to write ghost stories. Yeah. It took her a while, I think, to get up the courage to do this. But after a while, she started to write ghost stories. And, you know, my feeling about Edith Wharton is that she was an artist who saw the things in life that limited her or made her feel afraid as a creative opportunity, as like fuel. She was going to like use this as a way to work her, like to write her way through it. I think a lot of the characters in her novels suffer fates that she herself escaped. But I think that she kind of like was afraid these things would happen to her. So she kind of poured them into her characters, and her characters maybe don't end so well. But Wharton, she comes out all right, I think, in her own life, and frees herself from a lot of things. So I think the ghosts were like that as well. I think she was so afraid of ghosts. So she said, that's it. I'm going to write ghost stories.
And then
I'm going to move through it that way.
Isn't it crazy that her own house, now she did not die in that house. She moved, correct, to Europe?
She did. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of crazy that her house ends up definitely haunted, would you say? Since you've spent quite a bit of time there, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would. I mean, you know, as a ghost tour guide, I try to represent, what I really try to represent is mystery more than like certainty about anything, about any of it. And when people come on the tours, I always ask them, do you believe in ghosts? Some do, some don't, some are not sure. And I really want it to be the kind of experience where all are welcome, regardless of where you are in that, you know, spectrum of belief, because I don't really want it to be something that is a certain thing. I want it to be more of a question that we're asking as we go through this, like what is, and that was my own experience, you know, like, what is this? And what's going on here? And like, how are people having this these experiences, and is this for real? And you know, and just sort of asking those questions, because I feel like when you're in that state where you're wondering and you're open to possibility, that's when you can have these experiences that are pretty extraordinary, like sort of beyond the everyday, you know. And that's really, more than anything, that's the place that I hope people will get into with the ghost tour. So I really don't come down on either, you know, I guess I'm a little cheeky about it, or I'm a little coy. Like, I don't say it for sure either way. But I have had experiences there that are pretty hard to explain in any other way than ghosts.
Can you share one of them?
Yeah, well, I think the big moment for me, I was doing these tours for years, telling these stories, sort of just wondering about it and just kind of living with the mystery of it. And one night, this group contacts me, the Mass Paracon group. This is a group of paranormal investigators, psychics, and mediums. And they were coming to the Berkshires to do a conference, and could they come to the Mount for a late night private tour? This was 2019. You know, I had done my regular public tour that night, and then this group descends on the Mount from across, from next door. They were staying at the inn next door, and they come, you know, trudging through the woods all together, and they show up at the stable ready for a tour. Like I said, these were like seasoned investigators and psychics and mediums. So it made the question that I usually ask at the beginning of my tour, do you believe in ghosts, kind of funny. Because, you know, I mean, these are people that were really hardcore and really into it. And so they were like, oh, yeah, yeah. And what I realized is that this was not going to be like my regular public tour. This was really going to be more of a collaboration, because I was going to tell them about the experiences other people have reported, but they were also going to share with me what they were picking up, what they were feeling, and what they believed to be going on at the Mound. And so it really became a pretty fascinating experience where, like, I would tell them something that people report in a certain location, and then they would tell me what they were feeling and, like, provide a little bit more context and
insight. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, like, why people were experiencing those things in that location. And I said, wow, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but that's pretty interesting. And at the end of the night, we were at the last location in the house, which is the top floor of the main house, right outside the room that we call the Henry James Suite, which is one of the guest bedrooms. Somebody turns to me and says, have you ever tried to talk to them? And I said, no, I talk about them. I don't talk to them. Let's be clear what my role is here, you know. And they said, well, you really should talk to them. They know you. You've been here for so long. At this point, I had been doing the tours for almost 10 years. They know you. They want to talk to you. But you won't talk to them, was sort of the feeling. So you really should try to reach out to them. And you know, this for me was honestly a little bit of an initiation, because I wasn't used to sort of taking on that role of sort of communicating directly with the spirits. I wasn't sure I was ready for that, but you know, it was a moment, and everybody was kind of hoping I would, and I said, all right, let's do it. So we get out someone gets out an audio recorder, and I said, let's do an EVP session. And so he starts up his audio recorder. The first question I asked was, do you know my name? And, you know, as you do when you do EVP, there was, you know, long silence after. And then I asked another question, left a long silence. And we didn't hear anything in the room, but we went back downstairs. We played back the audio. And as soon as I asked, do you know my name? Oh, man, there's a voice. It sounds very clear, but kind of gravelly and scratchy, but clearly coming through. And it sure does sound like it says, Robert.
Oh, yeah. And it's so crazy because you're sitting there in there and you didn't hear it then.
No, did not hear it then. And so I got, and for me, like, I've learned to pay attention to this feeling, which is the chills. Sometimes I get the chills in certain moments, like when I do the tour and moments like this. And that to me is like an indication that there's something happening, you know, that there's something near me or something coming through. And that's what I was getting, was just most like really intense chills. And it changed, like once that happened, it really did change the whole experience for me, because it made it so much more personal.
Yes.
It's like, wow, they really do know me, you know?
After that experience, did you get there and say, hey, I'm here, hope, you know, kind of talk to him? Because I have done that at different places I've lived, including my own house, which I don't feel is haunted. And if there's anything here, it's very loving and comforting and caring.
Yeah.
So, but I still talk to my house. I talk to pets that have passed, people who have passed. I don't know if that makes me a little crazy, but sometimes it just feels good to say it out loud.
Yeah, I know what that feels like.
So did you start kind of talking to the house and the spirits in it after that a little bit?
I think so. I think it did change the experience for me, because it made it feel more personal. And it really, like what they were saying to me was that these spirits feel a connection to me. And I felt like I needed to sort of reciprocate that in some way, that it was, you know, that I needed to honor that, you know, that feeling that they were saying that the house has for me, that I can't take that so lightly, that, you know, well, I'm just here to tell the stories.
And
no, I'm part of this, you know, it sort of was the feeling. And so it's true that like in the last couple of years, I haven't been doing the tours as frequently at the Mount as I used to. And, I have come back though for sort of special tours, like at Halloween, I came back and did a couple tours, and it really does feel like homecoming. And, it is, there's something that happens when I kind of walk back in there again, and it just feels like, I don't know, like a connection.
Bet.
And I do say something about it. I'm like, hello, I'm back.
Yeah, it's me. You
know? Now, yeah, it's me.
What is it about Lenox, Massachusetts? Was it a really rich city? Because the Mount is there. And then the whole reason I even came to you was I had stumbled upon Ventfort Hall. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
It's a hall,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Bedford. Yep.
And I came across that, which led me to you, because you do ghost tours there. And it's also in Lenox, Massachusetts. And it is huge. And
it
so is the Mount. Was there a lot of, I'm assuming, because a lot of us have heard of the Berkshires, not necessarily been there. I have not. I would love to go. So I'm assuming there was a lot of money in the Berkshires?
Well, you know, the Berkshires are interesting in that way, because they have, there's a range, you know, there has always been, you know, the sort of farming community. There's been throughout the 19th century, there was an industrial, you know, quite a lot of industrial activity, a lot of mills and, you know, the people who worked the mills. And of course you have families there that whose connection to the place go back for generations, not necessarily, you know, wealthy families, but just people who've been connected to the Berkshires for generations. And of course, long, long ago, the Mohicans, whose land it was. What happened was, during the Gilded Age, you had, and this was like sort of the end of the Civil War, beginning of the First World War, you had very wealthy people coming to places like the Berkshires to build these huge houses. And they were doing this in like Newport, Rhode Island, or the Hudson Valley. But certainly the Berkshires were on the map as one of the places where the sort of Gilded Age elite were going to build these huge houses. They were big houses, not as big as some of the houses in places like Newport, right? There are some that are truly gargantuan. The ones in the Berkshires are relatively modest, but they're still, you know, luxurious homes. And the Berkshires are sort of dotted with them all over the landscape. Some of them now, like the Mount and Ventfort Hall, you know, exist as museums. Some of them are other things entirely, like one of the Berkshire mansion or cottages, we call them.
Which is, may I interrupt? Cottage.
Yes, please. I know.
Cottage,
I always make a joke
not
about this.
The word I would pick.
Yeah, I know. And I think, you know, it's a reflection of how wealthy these people were, you know, that, you know, it's just a little cottage, you know. It's like what the Benford Hall is something like 28,000 square feet, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a cottage. It's not a cottage. But yeah, but some of these houses now are like places like Canyon Ranch, the spa resort in Lenox, also in Lenox, and other things, hotels and things like that. Yeah, the Mount and Benford Hall are two of them in Lenox that are now house museums. And the Mount, as we said, was Edith Wharton's home. And Benford Hall was the home of the Morgans, George and Sarah Morgan. Sarah Morgan was J.P. Morgan's sister. These are pretty wealthy and well-connected people that were coming and building these huge estates.
And it seems to, when I was reading about the history of Ventfort, it just seems to have a lot of tragedy associated with it, with people kind of dying before their time.
Right. Like Sarah Morgan in particular, she, you know, she built the house, she and her husband George built the house in 1893. And I believe it was 3 years later, she died very suddenly of a heart condition. And she was in her mid-50s. She was so young. And so it is very tragic because for her, this was like a dream come true. She was finally able to have this beautiful home that she had dreamed of for so long. And she wanted to enjoy it with her friends and have these wonderful parties. And that was like a real joy, real love for her was to do that. And then she died very suddenly. It was very tragic.
And this cottage, and I just used air quotes, but you don't know that, but I did. But this cottage, it was 28,000. It is 28,000 square feet. It has 550 rooms. I mean, this place is massive.
Yeah. And it's, you know, particularly when you consider that it really was just Sarah and George who lived there. And it was only really for the summertime, like May through October is generally when they used the house. And I mean, they had servants and others who lived with them, but it really, as far as the primary residence of the house, it was just the two of them. And then whoever was visiting, you know.
And so it went through some change of hands. And then at one point, were they going to renovate it? Because I was reading that a nursing home developer was going to put a nursing home in there. And they're like, not doing that.
Yeah. The story is that, you know, after Ventfort Hall went through a number of different owners, and it was other things. It was a hotel for a while. It was a ballet school. It was a religious community was in residence there. Then it went to this land developer who had plans, as you said, to sort of turn it into, I believe it was assistant living facility. And a local community organization formed to raise money to buy the house from him so that they could save it and then restore it. And so that's the group that sort of saved Ventfort Hall from being lost and has worked since then on, you know, putting it back together again. And now they have, you know, music, they do events there as a house museum.
I was reading that during the renovations, and this would have been in your book, that during the renovations that they think that might have stirred up some activity at that time. Or do you think, I mean, just looking at it, it looks like it could have been haunted for a very long time.
Yeah. And, you know, you do get, you know, I think, and I can't speak to this quite yet because I don't have the full story, but this is what happens sometimes is you get these little, like, you know, hints that there might be more. Somebody who visited the house recently has some sort of family connection, I believe, to someone who used to live in the house long ago. And there might have been some stories of very old experiences, but I'm not sure yet. So this is where I have to go looking for the story to see what else there might be. But really the earliest story that I know of came from the days when it was the ballet school. So this would have been like in the 60s and 70s when it was the ballet school. And what I was told was that the students at the school would often see someone like an old woman in 1920s style clothing walking up the staircase behind them, but they would only see her in the mirror that stood on the staircase. And as soon as they turned around to look at her, she wouldn't be there. And that's sort of the oldest story. More recently though, I mean, like the activity that sort of that you mostly hear about now comes online, like during the time that it's a house museum, and the people that work there now and have experiences of it. And I used to say actually that it really only started when it became a museum. But during one of my ghost tours, a woman who was in the group that night interrupted me at this point and said, well, actually, I need to tell you that I used to work for the land developer. And that's actually not true, that things were happening then too, she said. In fact, she said it was one of her jobs to hire the men who would come in and work on the house. And she started to have a problem getting these guys to come in and work because of the experiences that they were having. And they didn't want to come back.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, and they talked about, she said it was often like they would see this shadow figure in one of the rooms on the second floor called the green room. And it freaked these guys out so bad that they were like, yeah, you know what? I don't want to make the money. I'm good. I don't need to go back there, you know?
And you know it's haunted when people won't work there.
Right. Because that always amazes me. It's like, you know, it's your job, right? Like you're getting paid good money to work here, but they would rather not. That was something. And so this is what often happens with these tours or with just like with these kinds of like with these locations where you think you've heard all the stories, but then you find you meet someone who has their own experience with the place and you learn that there's more than you knew.
And it's got to be kind of exciting as someone who hosts the ghost tours to hear stories like that from other people.
It is, because it just, you know, it does that thing where it sort of widens our view a little bit more, where we start to see a more of a picture of the place. You know, it starts to come more into focus, where you every time you get one of these little stories, you get like a little bit more of an understanding of the place. And like, but really what also then comes with it is like a whole lot more questions, you know, about it. But it's just like, I always think of it as like an itch you can't ever really scratch. You can't really nail it down. And that has definitely been true of the Mount. There are so many stories about the Mount. I'm like amazed all the time because I've been doing the Mount's ghost tours for, you know, over a decade. I've heard so many stories about it. And I've talked to so many people who have had experiences there, but because so many people like lived there or have been involved with the Mount for so long, it's never ending. There's just new people all the time telling me things that they experienced there.
Which is kind of exciting, actually.
Yeah. And I think it's especially awesome because of what the Mount is, the home of a storyteller. You know, of a woman who devoted her life to writing stories and imagining, you know, characters and situations and like, you know, and here this house is a place now that like inspires so many stories.
Exactly.
Right,
of that's true.
People's experiences. Yeah. So I love that about the Mount.
Have you had any experiences in Ventfort?
I have. There's this thing that happened once to me, like at the Mount, where this, it feels like very gently, feel like your hair is being touched, like somebody's just kind of running their hand over the top of your head a little bit. And again, I got the chills, you know, and that's how I know. and then I used to say, so when I started doing the ghost tours at Ventfort, I would tell people that this is something that people report, this same kind of experience is something that people report at Ventfort Hall, particularly in the library, where they feel like their hair is being touched or their head, you know, a hand is gently patting the top of their head. And I would say, but I've never experienced it here, but I have had that experience at the Mount, and kind of leave it at that. One night as I was getting ready to do the tour, I was kind of sitting alone in the library, and I was actually near the window with the sort of velvet curtains drawn behind me. So I was kind of in this little alcove beside the window and knew that there was no one near me. But I suddenly felt that same feeling again, the hand, like the just this gentle touch on the top of the head. And I got the chills. And I was like, oh, hello.
I'm not alone.
I guess I can't say that I've never experienced it here. You know, so I have had some experiences there, yeah.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with Robert Oakes about his book, Ghostly Tales of the Berkshires. For more information, visit his website at robertoakes.net. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, you can become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts where you can try it for 3 days free. Or you could sign up at patreon.com/thegravetalks. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us at The Grave Talks, thank you very much for listening.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.